Thank you for listening to The Rest is History. For bonus episodes, early access, ad-free listening, and access to our chat community, sign up at restishistorypod.com. That's restishistorypod.com.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
For my own part, I would as soon be descended from that heroic little monkey who braved his dreaded enemy in order to save the life of his keeper, or from that old baboon who, descending from the mountains, carried away in triumph his young comrade from a crowd of astonished dogs, as from a savage who delights to torture his enemies, offers up bloody sacrifices, practices infanticide without remorse, treats his wives like slaves, knows no decency, and is haunted by the grossest superstitions. So that, Dominic, was Charles Darwin, I think, friend of the show.
He sounds very miserable in that reading, Tom. God, he sounds very downbeat and hangdog.
He's not. He's sticking up for monkeys and for apes. And I should just add that that was in The Descent of Man, which, right, of course, is the book in which he famously points out that man, too, is an ape.
Yes.
And so there were lots of cartoons, weren't there, in the 19th century, which portrayed Darwin as either a monkey or an ape.
Yeah.
And we should point out, shouldn't we, at the head of this show, which we have titled History's Greatest Monkeys, that we are also bundling apes into the discussion and that monkeys and apes are not the same thing.
Well, this is the thing, Tom. This hangs over this whole story. So Sambrook Jr. said to me before I started that if I introduce it, I should say that I was delighted that we were being joined today by a top baboon, Tom Holland. But I can't do that joke now, but I've done it anyway.
No. Sorry.
But this issue, see, we've chosen the greatest primates in history, the most interesting and colourful primates in history. But
not man.
Not man, Tom. And also, some of my choices, I'm not sure they are monkeys, because a baboon is a monkey, is it? A baboon is a monkey?
No, baboon is an ape.
Oh, no.
So you can tell, basically, monkeys have tails and apes don't.
Yeah.
And apes have kind of broader chests and they can swing through trees. And they tend to be a little bit cleverer.
Okay.
So obviously humans have broad chests, very smart.
Yeah.
Swing through trees.
Yeah, all the time.
And also, I mean, if you find yourself with a creature that looks like either a monkey or an ape and it's dead, you can dissect it and see if it's got an appendix or not. And if it has an appendix, then it's an ape. And if it doesn't, then it's a monkey.
A monkey does not have an appendix.
No.
Interesting.
The rest is primatology.
And so a chimpanzee is an ape?
It's an ape, yes.
A lemur, however, is a monkey, or is that just a lemur?
It's got a tail.
Right. A macaque?
A macaque is a monkey.
Yeah.
Hold on. Is a lemur? I don't know. Isn't a lemur a lemur?
Well, this is the thing. We should have prepared this before we started broadcasting. We're a history podcast. We're not a lemur podcast. So anyway, human beings and monkeys have obviously interacted from the dawn of time, haven't they? And people have always looked into the soul of monkeys and apes and seen themselves looking back. Can you see yourself looking back from a soul? Maybe you can.
So lemurs are primates.
Oh, you've been looking that up all this time.
An order that includes monkeys, apes, and humans. So I don't think they are monkeys.
Monkeys, apes, and humans.
But they are primates.
But you see, that thing that you just quoted distinguishes between an ape and a human.
Yeah.
But a human is an ape.
I know. It's so complicated. This is why I was never, you know, zoology. It's very complicated.
We've done some complicated subjects on the rest of this history, but none yeah. as... So we've got a whoop or a flange.
A flange.
Of top historical monkeys. And Tom, I believe you're going to kick us off. You've got a brilliant monkey, or have you? Well, let's find out.
So the thing is, and I think that this will be true of all the monkeys or apes that we're looking at over the course of this show, humans have been fascinated by them because they are like us. And so therefore, even more than dogs or cats or whatever, they can be adopted and kind of given almost human roles.
Right.
And so I want to begin with, it is a macaque, which we've already mentioned as being a monkey, although it's better known in Europe as a Barbary ape.
Oh yeah.
It's not an ape, but it's a kind of monkey that's indigenous to North Africa. So land of the Berbers. But probably the most famous one is actually not in North Africa, but in Gibraltar. So the Gibraltar apes, and it's said that if they leave, then Gibraltar will fall. But they apparently were not indigenous to Gibraltar.
Okay.
Because no classical author mentions them.
So they brought over by the Moors, maybe, Tom?
Yeah, maybe. But what we do know is that there were macaques to be found in the Roman Empire right the way through. And the most intriguing one, this is my first top monkey. This is a monkey whose remains were uncovered in 2001 in a pass through the Pyrenees. So just inside Spain, but right on the border with France. It's the town of Llivia, or Iulia Libica, as it was called by the Romans. And this is a grave. It had been dug out and this monkey had been laid to rest in it. It was found near to a great building, great public building, dating back to the kind of the heyday of the Roman Empire. But this had been repurposed in late antiquity. And there was this monkey, probably, they've done tests on it, about 5.5 years old. So it had died early.
Yeah.
And its teeth were in a fairly shocking state, had very bad dentistry. So probably it hadn't died of old age. It hadn't had the right diet, basically.
Right.
And it's been dated to the end of the 5th century.
Okay.
So in the absolute dying days of Roman power in the West. And it's been buried with various grave goods. So food in pots, kind of various ornaments, but above all, military kit. So belt buckles.
Okay.
And various kind of iron plates suggesting that this was armor. And belt buckles are particularly associated with barbarian burials because the Romans didn't bury people with funerary goods.
Right.
So the question is...
Is he a Visigothic?
Is this a Roman macaque? So, or a Visigothic macaque?
So hold on, Tom. It's in the Pyrenees. Is it in the Pyrenees?
It's in the Pyrenees, yeah.
Is that the Vandals, the Visigoths?
It could be either.
Yeah.
But it's definitely under Roman control. So it's either barbarian kind of foederati, so people employed by the Romans.
Right.
Or Romans who, one might say, are aping barbarian style.
Very good. Very good. I like it.
Back of the net.
So, Tom, is the implication of this that the Empire's got a manpower problem?
They've turned... They're recruiting monkeys.
The Empire is recruiting macaques. Is that what's happening?
I think it's obviously a kind of mascot for the regiment.
Right. Yeah.
And clearly much loved.
Well, hold on. Those are expensive stuff, right? The belt buckle and all that. I mean...
Yeah. Well, I think he's been enrolled in the unit, I would guess.
Right.
A bit like Wojciech.
The bear.
The bear who became a corporal in the Polish army in the Second World War.
Yeah.
So I think a little bit like that, perhaps.
Yeah.
So there are other examples of this as well. So the idea of giving macaques, you know, they're treated as pets throughout the history of the Roman Empire, giving them formal burial is something that you can trace throughout military bases. So buried monkeys have been found in forts in Gaul, in Germany. There's even one been found in Yorkshire. So it's an exciting fact.
That's nice. Yeah.
But they were also kept as pets. So it wasn't necessarily military. So Marshall makes a joke about a guy having an ape that looks like an ape.
Right.
What kind of ape that was, I don't know. The remains of a baby macaque were found in Pompeii.
Oh, wow. In Pompeii.
So another one was found in an acropolis outside Poitiers.
Yeah.
So it's all going on. And I reckon you could make a case that when the empire fell, the ownership of macaques, of Barbary apes,
yeah.
were seen as markers of Romanitas, of kind of Roman class, of the sophistication of the vanished empire. And you can see this in the kind of opposite ends of the empire. So in Britain, quite a lot of macaques have been found in kind of, let's call them Dark Ages
yeah.
settlements, because we don't know anything about how they got there, what they were doing there. So there's one in Wroxeter.
Oh, Shropshire.
Abandoned Roman town, very near you.
Yes.
Again, it's kind of been buried there. And it suggests, I think, that it's a little bit like the wine going to Tintagel, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
It's people in Britain warlords there wanting to lay claim to a touch of Roman class. But the other example of this, I think, is at the opposite end of the empire in Syria, after the collapse of Roman power there and the takeover by the Arabs, and the Umayyads come to power, Muawiyah, the first Umayyad, and then his son, Yazid, who is incredibly unpopular with Muslims today. He has a very bad reputation. So the Shia hate him because he is the guy who kills Hussein, who is the grandson of Muhammad, at the Battle of Karbala,
right,
in Iraq.
Yeah.
And Sunni Muslims hate him because he is seen as drunkard. He burns down the Kaaba. He does all kinds of terrible things. And so he's seen as a very bad caliph after the four righteously guided caliphs who kick everything off, according to tradition. And the thing that sums up how bad a caliph Yazid is that he has a monkey, a favorite monkey, who he calls Abu Qais. And he would enter him into horse races.
Horse races?
Yeah, although Abu Qais would ride a donkey.
As a jockey, presumably.
As a jockey. So he's riding a donkey and all the other guys are riding horses.
Yeah.
And when he dies, it's said that Yazid ordered everyone in Syria to mourn him. And again, this thing that the monkey should be given a proper formal burial. So he's kind of wrapped up in a white shroud and laid to rest. And there is a hadith, which is in the great collection of hadiths by Tabiri, where there is this ringing statement: cursed be the man who becomes our caliph while keeping as his closest friend a monkey. So
it's a lesson for all of us there, Tom, I think, isn't
there? I really think there is.
Crikey.
Yes.
Crikey.
And people who listened to our episode on Baghdad may remember that Zubaydah, the favorite wife of Harun al-Rashid, also had a monkey. And so I think it's possible that the reason why Muslim scholars are so hostile to monkeys is perhaps because it has a hint of the Roman about it.
Oh, right. Nice. Yeah.
So I don't know.
Seems exotic and sort of decadent, maybe. Is that it?
Kind of Caesarist.
Yes, exactly.
Because the Umayyads were accused, again, of aping the Caesars, of wanting to be like a Caesar.
Very good, Tom. Very good. You can never employ that pun too much, I think, in this episode.
It's the most used, isn't it, really?
It is the most used, exactly. All right. That's good. Monkeys in antiquity. Would you like a more modern monkey?
Yeah, I would. Particularly because I know what you've got. So
we've both chose our own monkeys, and I thought I'd go in quite big, come out fighting, as it were, Tom. So we are in London in the 1820s, and this is the life and career of a monkey called Jacko Macaco.
It's an excellent name. And he's a macaque, is he?
Well, we're going to come to this, Tom.
Okay.
There's a lot of mysteries about Jacko Macaco, which I think go to the heart of being a historian, because his story ultimately is one about the unknowability of the past. So to get into his story, we could turn, for example, to Pictures of Sporting Life and Character, 1860, by William Pitt Lennox. And he has a section in this. So in this book, it's all about sort of the days of the Regency and the bull baiting and cockfighting and stuff that went on. And Jacko Macaco is in this book. And William Pitt Lennox says, you know, like a lot of top sportsmen, he started at the bottom and worked his way up. So he fought in the Chick Lane and Tottenham Court Road pits, the fighting pits.
Are these quite kind of low grade?
This is sort of National League, Vanarama League, or whatever it's called.
Right.
There he was known as the Hoxton Ape. And then he fought his way up and he was finally sold to the Real Madrid, or the Wolverhampton Wanderers, a fight sort of entrepreneurs, who was a guy called Charles Astrop, who ran the Westminster Pit, which I will explain in due course.
And this is the kind of the Molyneux of...
Exactly so, Tom. Now, Charles Astrop actually told a different story himself. So this is the unknowability of the past. Charles Astrop said that Jacko had once belonged to a sailor, and they'd had a fight, Jacko and the sailor, about a saucer of milk. Jacko had bitten off three of the sailor's fingers. The sailor sold him to a silversmith from Hoxton called Carter. Under false pretenses, he said he was very meek and mild. Carter had to buy himself a sheet of iron to use as a shield when he approached Jacko, because Jacko was so fierce. And eventually, he tired of being attacked by his own pet. He took him to a field and set a dog on him to try and get rid of him. But Jacko defeated the dog.
That's the obvious way to get rid of a monkey, isn't it?
And a second dog.
That is so Regency.
And so Carter thought, aha. And so he sold him to the Westminster Pit. Now, just before we get onto the Westminster Pit, a quick reflection about Jacko and his name and his appearance. So his name. Going to be a lot of Jackos and Jacks in this podcast, Tom, I have to say. I think I've got about six of them.
And I've got one.
The sense is that this is probably a generic name at the time. First of all, Jacko specifically was probably a generic name for a lemur. So lemurs were called Jacko.
But also there's a slight sense of he's come from the sea, and people from the sea, of course, were called Jaktars.
Yeah.
And as for Macaco,
yeah,
Macaco was a generic name at the time applied particularly to macaques, but also to monkeys more broadly. Cockneys in the East End of London would call any monkey Macorker.
Love it.
And indeed, there's some evidence that Jacko Macaco may actually just be a generic name that you'd call any monkey Jacko Macaco.
But it wasn't that he became so famous that...
We don't know. We just don't know.
This is the unknowability, isn't it?
It's the unknowability, exactly.
But do we know what he is? Is he a macaque?
Well, some people say a baboon. Some people say a mandrill or a gibbon.
Oh, a mandrill, but presumably not a bonobo.
No, because they're very peaceful.
Yeah.
He was so well known. He was the Cristiano Ronaldo of his day. So he's so well known that there are etchings of him in the British Museum. There's one by Thomas Landseer, which shows him with a muzzle and pointed ears. And people think that therefore he's probably a rhesus macaque. Anyway, so he's gone to the Westminster Pit. Now, to give you a sense of the Westminster Pit, it's very near the Palace of Westminster in London, so the Houses of Parliament. It was at its peak of popularity when hundreds, if not thousands, of people would come to watch these bouts in the 1820s. It would have badger baiting, monkey baiting, bull baiting. Its biggest star was it's actually a dog called Billy. Billy was famous for killing rats, Tom. In October 1822, he killed 100 rats in 6 minutes and 25 seconds. 100 rats!
Wow.
Think of that.
Goodness. So what, do they just kind of keep rats in cages and let them out?
Well, there was controversy. Some people said actually a lot of the rats had been poisoned beforehand because, of course, there's huge amounts of money changing hands on all this.
Of course. Yeah, so betting syndicates and things.
It's betting syndicates. So Jacko is going into this very high-pressure environment. When he is billed, when people say they've got the Hoxton ape, big star, rising star, better than Billy, quite a lot of the sort of the swells, you know, dandies and people would come to watch. So bigger and bigger money. There are adverts preserved from the time. There's one here, Jacko was open to challenges from any dog in England for 100 guineas.
God, so he's taking on dogs. Does he take on the dog who's killed all the rats?
No, I don't think he does. That's a different class.
Different league.
Yeah, different league. No, but he will take on dogs twice his weight.
Yeah.
So Jacko is about 12 pounds in weight. That's about 5.5 kilograms. And he will fight a dog of up to double that. Now, we know about his style because Lennox describes it in his book. His mode of attack, he says, was first to present his back or neck to the dog and to shift and tumble about until he could lay hold on the arm or chest when he ascended to the windpipe.
Oh, God.
Clawing and biting away, which usually occupied him for a minute and a half. And it said, after every bout, the monkey exhibited a frightful appearance, being deluged with blood, but it was that of his opponent alone.
Mm.
So he's got a good ring record. We think he overcame 14 different opponents. And his advert, that advert that I quoted, says of him, he has fought some of the best dogs of the day, including his combat with the wonderful bitch Puss of Tea Cribs and the famed Oxford one. We don't know who the famed Oxford one is. Now, there is a suspicion of foul play that hangs over this. There's a splendid fellow called George Charles Grantley Fitzharding Barclay.
He sounds a swell.
He was a Whig MP, Tom. He was a Whig. And a great enthusiast for sport. He wrote a memoir, and he says in his memoir, I believe that the dogs were injured first.
Right.
Again, to rig the matches.
Because the spectacle of a monkey killing a dog would be more dramatic and interesting to people.
Right. And a lot of analysts, top analysts, said a monkey cannot kill a dog. A macaque will not defeat a top quality dog. This is rigged.
And so entire fortunes are being lost as a result.
Correct. So the most famous bout is the one that I alluded to there. It's the bout against Puss, who was owned by Tom Cribb.
And is confusingly a dog.
Puss is confusingly a dog. And I have to apologise to some people, because I was telling people about this last week and I had only scanned the reading, so I thought Puss was a cat. So I've been telling people publicly that Jacko Macaco had a climactic bout against a cat. Not the case.
Well, I think there's a lesson there for any young historians listening to this.
Yes, read your sources properly.
Don't go public with your research until you've properly... Yeah.
No, exactly. So Puss belonged to a guy called Tom Cribb, who was himself a remarkable person. He was the All England boxing champion, and he was the fellow, Tom, who had defeated Tom Molyneux in Oxfordshire in 35 rounds in 1810. The famous fight held in the middle of nowhere against a former American slave.
Was that in Hampshire? I thought it was in Hampshire, wasn't it?
Shennington Hollow. I think there are multiple such fights, to be honest with you. So Puss, he belonged to Tom Cribb anyway, who's this retired sporting star himself.
Is he now running a pub or something?
Exactly. Now, Puss is a dog that doesn't exist anymore. He's not a bull terrier. He's a bull and terrier, which is a slightly different thing. And their great fight seems to have happened in June 1821. There was £50 at stake. A lot of money, actually, in the early 1820s.
Yeah, fortune.
And our account comes from a guy who was the MP for Galway called Richard Martin, who was an old Harrovian, an abolitionist, and a notorious do-gooder.
But Harrovians love torturing animals, don't they? Because that's what they did instead of playing sport. They go and torture cats.
At school. They went around beating cats to death.
Yeah.
But obviously this Richard Martin has been deeply affected by this because he becomes, as part of being MP for Galway, he's a passionate campaigner against cruelty to animals. He campaigned particularly against bull baiting and cockfighting, so much so that George IV nicknamed him Humanity Dick. So now he makes reference to this great fight in the House of Commons a year later. He's introducing a prevention of cruelty to animals bill, and he says, the Jacko Macaco puss fight is the nadir of British cruelty to animals. And he says the fight lasted for half an hour. The dog had its carotid artery severed, bleeding, and Jacko's jaw was torn off.
Oh, God.
And he lingered for 2 more hours and then died. Very sad. Now, the guy who owned the Westminster Pit went ballistic when he heard this. He said this was an absolute lie. He said, actually, Jacko defeated puss in 2.5 minutes. Didn't kill Puss. Puss was defeated, but lived to tell the tale. And that Jacko actually died 15 months later of an unrelated illness. And Mr. Astrop from the Westminster Pit said, listen, I've had Jacko stuffed. He is on the mantelpiece of a Mr. Shaw of Mitcham Common. And this would not have been possible if his jaw had been ripped off.
I mean, that's something that it would be nice to see, wouldn't it? Is famous stars being stuffed after their death.
Definitely.
And donated to the grounds that they adorned.
Yeah, I would love to see that, Tom.
Wouldn't you like that?
Would you like to see Jack Grealish at Villa Park?
We'd all love to see Grealish back at Villa Park, yes.
Yes, but a stuffed Tom.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, Ian Botham, who, of course, whose nickname was Guy the Gorilla.
Right.
You'd like to see him stuffed and put up in Taunton.
Definitely. So anyway, that is the story of Jacko Macaco. And we don't have much insight into his inner life, I think it's fair to say, Tom. But I think he's a lovely window into the sporting world of George IV's England.
Yeah. I think in the episode we did on public schools, we talked about how organisations were set up to stop cruelty to animals before cruelty to children.
Yeah.
And I have to say that hearing that, you can kind of see why.
Well, Humanity Dick was an absolutely key figure in setting up the Society for the Protection of Cruelty to Animals, later the Royal Society, but not at the time, because George IV thought this was...
George IV was contemptuous.
He thought it was wokery. He thought it was madness.
Woke tosh.
Total woke tosh. Who wouldn't want to see a dog killing 100 rats?
Well, I'm a big fan of Humanity Dick.
Okay.
Bless him. So is that it? Is that Jacko Macaco?
That's the story of Jacko Macaco. And I think the lesson, Tom, is the mysteriousness of the past, because we just don't know where he came from, what kind of monkey he was, if he was indeed a monkey.
How he died. Yeah.
I mean, there were even that guy with six names who was the son of the Earl of Berkeley. He said the fight with Puss was a complete con. In his memoirs, he says, I was looking very closely, and before the fight began, Tom Cribb, the former boxer, was cradling Puss's head in a mysterious way.
Oh, yeah.
And I believe he cut Puss before it started to make the bout last longer and maybe to win a little bit of money,
yeah,
and so on and so forth. Our executive producer, Jack Davenport, used to work as a sports journalist, wasn't he?
Yeah.
He worked in the boxing world. So he may have insights into all this that we just can't even pretend to have.
Well, we should ask him and maybe mention it on the bonus.
Yeah.
But I think, I mean, what that again suggests, rather like the thing on the monkeys with the Roman garrison, is the ability to identify with monkeys and to admire them and perhaps even, Dominic, to love them.
Yeah.
So it's obviously a branch of the entertainment industry, isn't it? Sport.
It is.
But so is cinema.
You've got a cinematic monkey.
So I just thought it would be interesting to look at the role that monkeys and particularly apes and specifically chimpanzees have played in Hollywood and also in TV, because a bit like Rin Tin Tin, the dog who we mentioned in History's Top Dogs,
yeah,
who became a big Hollywood star, chimpanzees were featuring in Hollywood shorts right from the beginning. So in 1916, there was a famous Hollywood chimpanzee couple called Napoleon and Sally, who starred in a whole number of shorts. And there was one that came out in 1916 where Napoleon is called up to the army and Sally follows him and there's a big battle. And it all ends happily. And I haven't actually seen this film, but the account I read of it, it said,
yeah,
it ends with Sally eating a banana.
Oh,
so that's kind of cheery. Nice. But there's also, on a darker note, and again, this is about the unknowability of the past, there's an orangutan. So this is the first mention of an orangutan who is, he's called Pierre, and he is a film star in Austria. So the Viennese film industry.
Oh.
He'd been trained for motion picture work, according to the various newspapers that cover this. And he, and I'm quoting, reportedly nursed a grudge against a brutal trainer for a long time. And when the opportunity arose that they were alone together high in a tree, strangled the trainer and threw his body to the ground.
What was the trainer doing up in the tree?
I don't know, Dominic, because I have Googled and Googled and Googled this, and this is all that I can find. And basically, it's a single sentence that is reproduced in multiple American newspapers.
Yeah.
And I know nothing more about it.
Oh, tantalizing, Tom.
Tantalizing.
Yeah.
So again, I mean, if we have any, maybe any Austrian listeners, anyone in Vienna who are au fait with
orangutan specialists.
Yeah. Again, please let us know. But of course, there have been some very famous stars who have acted opposite apes. Clint Eastwood, of course.
Yeah, Clint Eastwood.
Yeah, but also our old friend, Dominic.
Ronald Reagan. Yeah.
So Bedtime for Bonzo,
yeah,
in which he's opposite a chimp. Bonzo was played by Peggy.
Right.
So that came out in 1951. But the following year, Bonzo goes to college. Confusingly, Peggy has been replaced and is placed by a chimpanzee called Bonzo.
No.
Again.
What are the chances?
So I spent hours trying to work out, was this a coincidence?
Yeah.
Was he named after Bonzo? I don't know. Anyway.
Crikey.
But Dominic.
Yeah.
I said they didn't just appear in films. They also appeared in TV. And probably the most famous one is it was a baby chimp called Scatter. And Scatter appeared in Memphis on a TV channel there. A show called Scatter's World. And it was obviously a kind of down market version of the Mickey Mouse Club. So you could join the Scatter Club. But the problem is that Scatter grows up and starts to become a little bit aggressive.
Oh, no.
And there's quite a lot of throwing of fecal matter, which obviously I guess the children would love.
Yeah.
But I mean, they're not going to put this out.
The parents wouldn't love it.
And so they need to find a new home. So the guy who, interestingly, is a fake colonel. He's a bogus colonel in Memphis. So he turns to another bogus colonel in Memphis, Colonel Tom Parker.
Okay. Yeah.
Because he knows that Elvis is very keen on having animals and is kind of developing a zoo in Gracelands. And so he gives Scatter to Elvis. And Elvis adores Scatter. And Scatter basically has the run of Gracelands. He's ripping down curtains. He's throwing his poo around, all that kind of stuff. He's chasing the housemaids. If Elvis throws parties and, you know, people have sloped off to a bedroom to get up to what they get up to, Scatter will burst in and start throwing poo at them. And he's an upskirter. If a woman comes in with a skirt, he will run up and flip the skirt up and peer up inside.
Oh, my word. That's bad behavior.
Which Elvis finds hilarious.
Right, yeah.
Yeah, it's very bad behavior. So Scatter is a difficult character, I think. And so much so that in the end, he vanishes from Gracelands, and there are conflicting accounts about what happened. So one says that he's banished by Elvis to a climate-controlled room where he dies of a broken heart.
Oh, Tom.
Because he's missing the king. As you would.
That's sad. That is sad.
And another one is that he bites a maid and the maid then poisons him.
Crikey. That's very Shakespearean.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. Great drama. But again, Dominic, I mean, as you said, it's the unknowability of the past. I mean, I guess there's a serious point that monkeys are sufficiently interesting that people note them and tell stories about them, but they're not so interesting that people trouble to actually find out what genuinely happened. Do you think?
Yeah, I think that's true because a dog... You know, if a king had a dog, the dog wouldn't even show up in the sources at all.
Yeah.
People wouldn't think to record it. Whereas a chronicler might say of somebody, he had a monkey, but then we wouldn't know where the monkey came from or what happened to the monkey, would we?
But Elvis's human associates, we know all about them. I mean, everybody who's ever met him has been chronicled. So,
and Tom, is there a well-known star who's obsessed with Elvis and emulates Elvis who has a monkey of his own?
There is. And this, of course, we've talked about Jacko.
Yeah.
So here is another Jacko, but confusingly, this Jacko is the human. So of course, it's Michael Jackson.
I hadn't thought of that. Very good.
And Michael Jackson is directly inspired by the example of Elvis and having Scatter. And so Michael Jackson says that he wants to have a little baby chimp. And this chimp comes from a Texas research facility. It's only 8 months old. And Michael Jackson, of course, calls him Bubbles. And in 1988, when Michael Jackson moves into Neverland, the Neverland Ranch, so very Gracelands again, Bubbles goes with him. And he sleeps in a crib in Jackson's room, supposedly. He wears a nappy, what our American listeners would call a diaper. Mm-hmm. He sits at the dining table. He comes with Michael Jackson into his private cinema to watch films. And he sits there snacking on candy,
yeah,
which can't be good for the diaper, is it?
No.
And he becomes, I think, much more than Scatter becomes a part of Elvis's image. I mean, Bubbles becomes a really important part of Michael Jackson's image.
Oh, totally. I don't think of Scatter when I think of Elvis, but I do think of Bubbles as emblematic of Michael Jackson's weirdness and infantilism.
Yeah, so I think Michael Jackson would be pleased about that because I guess he was wanting to trump the king.
Yes.
So you're right that there is this kind of infantilizing thing. So he goes to Japan and has tea with the mayor of Osaka and takes Bubbles with him. And the three of them kind of sit there. And the mayor of Osaka, you know, says, well, I've never had tea with a chimpanzee before. And yeah, he can't come to Britain because the quarantine laws won't permit it. So that's very sad. But I think there are all kinds of stories told about Bubbles that it's hard to know whether they're true. And that reflects the fact that Michael Jackson's oddness is such that it kind of encouraged all stories. So there's stories that Bubbles had his own bodyguard, that Michael Jackson had taught him to moonwalk, that Michael Jackson was doing a duet with Freddie Mercury and kept asking Bubbles what he thought. And Freddie Mercury was so pissed off that he stormed off.
Right. Yeah.
I think this is actually true because I think that track was subsequently released after Freddie Mercury's death. But Bubbles, a bit like Scatter, because this is what chimpanzees do. You know, he grows up, he becomes aggressive, he gets into the whole kind of throwing poo at the housemaids thing. This running thing that the housemaids in Rockstar's palaces hate chimpanzees, basically. And so eventually he has to be retired. So 2003, Bubbles is sent off to a pet trainer. In 2005, he is sent to a sanctuary for apes in Florida, where he stays to this day.
Still alive?
Yeah.
Well, that's nice.
So I looked up the site,
the
website for the Center for Great Apes website, because you can sponsor him.
He's not under an alias or something.
No, he's there as Bubbles, and all these kind of various apes, and they describe them, and if you want to, you can sponsor them. And it says of Bubbles that he will occasionally spit water or throw sand with amazing accuracy at strangers just to see how they react.
Yeah.
So he's still a bit of a funster. But Bubbles' caregivers consider him to be autistic, gentle, and shy. And I think this is really sad. He often will turn his back when he sees a camera.
Oh.
So.
Yeah. He's traumatized by paparazzi.
Ruined by
his
experience of fame.
Yeah. That's what fame does to you, Tom. Sad story.
But not as sad as Jacko Macaque.
See, Tom, you're projecting there. We don't know that Jacko Macaque.
But it's a possibility he had his jaw ripped off. I mean, I know he might not have done, but he got stuffed.
Yeah, that's all true. Our animal rights listeners will be horrified by this conversation. So we should probably move on before our audience completely plummets. Join us after the break for more exciting historical monkeys.
See you then.
This episode is brought to you by BetterHelp.
Bottling everything up is never a good idea. It can have terrible consequences. For instance, look at all the conflicts throughout history. I wonder how many of them could have been solved if they just talked things out.
And Tom, I have a confession for our listeners. As you know, I've been really struggling with anxiety about the massive series that we've got coming on The Rest is History, all the prep we have to do for that series on the French Revolution, the First World War. I mean, it's all mounting up, isn't it? And when we talked it out, I felt so much better now that I got all those crippling anxieties and insecurities off my chest.
If you want to talk, you can always talk to me. But if not, then I highly recommend therapy. It can help you learn positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. Therapy isn't just for those who've experienced major trauma. It empowers you, Dominic, to be the best version of yourself.
If you want to give therapy a try, why not check out BetterHelp? It's entirely online, it's convenient and flexible, and it's really easy to get started. You just fill out a brief questionnaire and they'll match you with a licensed therapist. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp.
Visit betterhelp.com/restishistory today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/restishistory.
Walmart Plus members save on meeting up with friends. Save on having them over for dinner with free delivery with no hidden fees or markups. That's groceries plus napkins plus that vegetable chopper to make things a bit easier. Plus, members save on gas to go meet them in their neck of the woods. Plus, when you're ready for the ultimate sign of friendship, start a show together with your included Paramount Plus subscription. Walmart Plus members save on this plus so much more. Start a 30-day free trial at walmartplus.com. Paramount Plus, Essential plan only. Separate registration required. See Walmart Plus terms and conditions.
I'm Anthony Scaramucci, former White House Director of Communications and Wall Street financier.
And I'm Katty Kay, U.S. Special Correspondent for BBC Studios. I've been covering American politics for almost three decades.
Welcome to The Rest is Politics U.S., brought to you by Goalhanger.
Go on, tell us, were those donations you made, like Obama in 2008, was that idealism? Were you hoping to get something out of these campaigns that would serve your own business interests, for example?
So I think this will either make this podcast incredibly successful, Katty, or people will be horrified and they'll shut it off right now, because I'm going to be very real with you. The Obama donation, I had gone to law school with President Obama. We were not classmates. I was a few years ahead of him. It was 2007. He was then Senator Obama. I had a check in my breast pocket. I went over to the senator. I said, Senator, I said, you and I didn't really know each other in law school, but I'm about to hand you a big check. Can I lie to my friends and tell them that you and I knew each other in law school? Well, Obama looks at me, had the best smile in American politics since Jack Kennedy.
Forever.
Yeah. He lights up. He looks at me and says, I'll tell you what, if you double the amount of the check, we'll take it back to Hawaii. Okay. And I looked at him. I said, you're done. I had another check in my pocket. I ripped it up. I doubled the amount of the check. And I'm going to tell you right now, I've been to more White House Christmas parties during the Obama administration than the Trump administration.
In this pivotal year for the United States, democracy, and world affairs, Britain's biggest podcast, The Rest is Politics, is launching stateside.
Uncovering secrets from inside the Biden and Trump inner circles and how they shape the world's most important economy, but also the global economy too.
New episodes are released every Friday morning.
Just search The Rest is Politics US wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, welcome back to our episode on history's top monkeys. We've had a fair few, but Dominic, we've got more. Top monkeys, we've got them.
Yeah, we do. So I thought what we would do now is, we're a cosmopolitan podcast. I think we haven't done a lot of South African history on The Rest is History. I think we should. And I've got a couple of South African monkeys that I think are extraordinary characters, Tom. So we mentioned in the first half that our executive producer, Jack Davenport, is called Jack. And I've actually got two more monkeys, both called Jack. So one is Jack the Signalman. I'll just mention him quite briefly. Jack the Signalman is a baboon.
Oh, brilliant to get a baboon on the show.
Yeah, great to get a baboon on The Rest is History. He worked for the Cape Town to Port Elizabeth Railway.
When you say he worked?
In the 1880s, well. So he belonged to a man called James Wide. James Wide, his nickname was Jumper, because he used to jump between the railway carriages. And one day, he mistimed his jump.
Oh, no.
And he lost both his legs.
Oh, dear.
So he bought this monkey, this baboon, to help him as a carer. The baboon would push him around in a trolley, and he taught the baboon, Jack, how to use the signals. Now, according to the periodical, The Railway Signal, Tom,
who knew,
from 1908, James Wide, quote, trained the baboon to such perfection that he was able to sit in his cabin stuffing birds, etc.
Deep water.
while the animal, which was chained up outside, pulled all the levers and points. Now, one day, somebody saw this on the railway and they complained to the railway authorities. And they sent, the Cape Town supporters of the railway sent an investigator called George B. Howe. And he wrote in his report, Jack knows the signal whistle as well as I do, every one of the levers. It was very touching to see his fondness for his master. As I drew near, they were both sitting on the trolley, the baboon's arms around his master's neck, the other stroking Wide's face. So it's quite a touching story. He was officially employed by the railway. He was paid 20 cents a day and half a bottle of beer a week. And it is said that in 9 years with the railway, he never made a single mistake. So there's a lesson there for Britain's railways, Tom.
Yes. So the government could just sack everyone involved on the railways and bring in baboons.
Exactly.
I mean, I was wondering how people on the trains felt about this.
Disturbed. This guy had complained to the authorities.
But if you're on a train and you're approaching a point that's operated by a baboon, I'd feel a bit nervous. I mean, I don't want to seem baboonist.
No. But in a sense, Tom, aren't we always getting trains operated by apes? I mean,
in a very real sense, we are. Yeah. Yes, I guess we are.
I mean, I'm doing a podcast with a load of apes right now. I mean, so are you.
Yeah.
So anyway, I really wanted to focus on another South African baboon, because South Africa is very strong in this department. And this is a chap called Corporal Jackie.
When you say chap, do you mean a baboon?
Yeah, he's a baboon. But I'm inclusive in my language. He lived on a farm in South Africa
with a chap called Albert Marr, who looked after him. And Albert Marr was drafted in 1915, was conscripted to go to the Great War. And he took Jackie, his baboon, with him, and he became a mascot for the 3rd South African Infantry Regiment, who were from the Transvaal.
So very like the Romans.
Very like the Romans, because he was given a cap, his own rations, he was given a pay book. And I've got all this from the South African military history website, The Observation Post, so a big shout out to them. Jackie wore his uniform with some panache. He was also known to light up a cigarette or pipe for his pals. He had a sharp salute for any officer passing him. He'd stand at ease when commanded to do so, placing his feet apart and hands behind his back in the military style. And at the mess table, he used a knife and fork and a teacup in the proper manner. And I have to say to people, if you Google Corporal Jackie, he looks hilarious because he's just this baboon looking completely nonplussed wearing this military.
Because in Planet of the Apes, they're soldiers of the orangutans, aren't they?
Yeah.
But it might be slightly similar.
I guess so, yes. He saw a lot of action. So he first saw action at the Somme in 1916. He and Albert Marr lived to tell the tale. Then they were sent to Egypt and Albert Marr was shot in the shoulder in Egypt. And Jackie was with him and Jackie licked the wound while others went to get help.
And he wasn't scared? He didn't run away?
No. Well, there's a terrible story coming up. So they went back to France and they were in France in the trenches and there was a huge explosion in the trenches and some shrapnel hit Jackie in the leg and arm. And stretcher bearers came and he was trying to sort of burrow into the ground to escape more firing.
Oh, how awful.
He wouldn't allow himself to be taken away by the stretcher. But eventually they did. And the doctor was so, you know, he's kind of working, patching up all these people. They bring a baboon in. It obviously made an impression on the doctor because he wrote an account of it. And he said, it was a pathetic sight. The little fellow, carried by his keeper, lay moaning in pain, the man crying his eyes out in sympathy. You must do something for him. He saved my life in Egypt. He nursed me through dysentery. The baboon was badly wounded, the left leg hanging with shreds of muscle, another jagged wound in his right arm. They gave him chloroform. They had a big debate, will this kill him, but they gave him chloroform. He lapped up the chloroform as if it had been whiskey, and he was well under in a remarkably short time. It was a simple matter to amputate his leg with scissors, and then I cleaned the wounds and dressed them as well as I could. So Corporal Jackie, he's lost his leg. He's had the chloroform, whatever. He wakes up. They send them back to England to convalesce, him and Albert Marr. He's a tremendous celebrity in England. He marches.
Well, he doesn't march. He hops, presumably.
In the Lord Mayor's show. The Lord Mayor's parade, Tom. He ends up raising money. They go around the country raising money for the Red Cross. People were paid half a crown each to shake Jackie by the hand. And 5 shillings, if you paid 5 shillings, you got to kiss him.
Wow.
So people are paying this. They raise a lot of money. They go back to South Africa. And again, he was present. He hopped through another parade, a peace parade in Church Square, Pretoria, on the 31st of July, 1920. He was given a medal and they went back to their family farm. There's a sad coda to this story, though. Both Marr and Jackie were a bit affected by shell shock. And actually, in May 1921, there was a tremendous storm over the Veldt, of the High Veldt, Tom, and a great crash of thunder. And Jackie obviously thought this was the return of kind of the Germans. Oh. And he had a heart attack and died.
Oh, dear. So, I was going to ask about shell shock.
Yeah.
I had not realised that baboons could get shell shock.
Well, why wouldn't they? If other apes can get shell shock, Tom.
Yeah.
So he's a very impressive character, I think, Corporal Jackie.
Very.
Yeah. He doesn't seem to have taken part in fighting, but he's...
tending to the men.
He's tending to the men and keeping their spirits up.
And saluting and everything.
Yeah. And eating his rations with a knife and fork and generally behaving, I think, very well.
Good. Well, I mean, I like to think there's a kind of bond between him and the unknown macaque in the Pyrenees.
Yeah, that's nice. It's a nice link.
Yeah. So these have all been very inspiring stories, stories that are all about the bond between human and ape or monkey or whatever. But my next story is a darker one. So we're in the Napoleonic Wars.
Yeah.
And we are in Hartlepool, which is in County Durham.
Tom, I know where this is going.
And the good people of Hartlepool, fishermen,
yeah,
mostly, they look out to sea. And there they observe a French ship. A storm is brewing. The French ship gets dashed against the rocks. Everyone drowns except for a single survivor. And this survivor is a monkey. And again, pursuing the military theme, or in this case, a nautical theme, the monkey is in a French uniform.
Right.
So he's kind of dressed in a Marine's uniform.
Yeah.
And this alarms the locals who have never seen a monkey and indeed have never seen a French person.
Well, this is the thing. How would you know?
Well, exactly. And so they assume that this strange creature in the military uniform, that this is what the French look like.
Hairy.
Yeah. Talking strange gibberish.
Ill-groomed.
Not speaking English.
Yeah.
So they assume that he must be a spy. And all the fishermen gather around on the beach and they start interrogating the monkey. And of course, the monkey can't answer their questions. And this simply confirms for them that he's a spy.
Yeah. You can't take chances, Tom.
And a Frenchman. Yeah. And so they hang the monkey. And from this point onwards, the people of Hartlepool are known as monkey hangers.
Yeah.
Now, listeners may be wondering, is this story actually true? Or is it invented by their near neighbours?
Don't do this, Tom. Come on, don't do this.
Well, I mean, who knows, Dominic? Who knows? Yeah. A very similar story is told about a number of isolated fishing communities along the length of Britain. So there's one in Cornwall, there's one in Scotland. I mean, same kind of thing. And there is a song that is very popular in the music halls of Britain in the mid-19th century, sung by a guy called Ned Corvin. Shall I sing it for you?
I think everybody would enjoy that, not just me.
In former times, mid war and strife, when French invasion threatened life, and all was armed to the knife, the fisherman hung the monkey, oh. Durum, 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 da. Durum, 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 da.
That's a nice bit.
Can you guess what the next line is?
Is it durum, 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 da?
It is. Durum, 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 da. The fisherman hung the monkey, oh. And so it goes on for quite a while, and I won't sing any more. And I think it is a generally held theory that actually this story emerges from the song rather than the other way around.
Oh.
So.
Oh, how interesting that is. The story was created to explain the song.
Yeah, I think the idea for the song came first.
But there is a massive twist to this story, isn't there, about Hartlepool and monkeys?
There is a massive twist because actually this monkey who gets hanged not only becomes a real character, but becomes the first ape in this episode to win political office.
Yes. Indirectly, I think it's fair to say.
And the story begins on the 31st of October, 1999, with Hartlepool United Football Club. Again, this kind of link between monkeys and sport,
yeah.
Also a kind of running theme. And the football club want a mascot, and they decide, well, let's have a monkey,
yeah.
This hanged monkey. And so they call the monkey Hangus, so H apostrophe, Angus, Hangus.
Yeah.
And they employ various people to play this mascot. And the key figure in this story, a historic figure, is the second guy who wins the chance to play Hangus. This is a man called Stuart Drummond, who is a local from Hartlepool. He's studied foreign languages. He's worked on cruise ships. So he's, you know, a man of the world.
Yeah.
And he's very excited at the opportunity. He's a big Hartlepool fan. He dresses up as Hangus every week. He gambles around on the pitch. He is twice escorted by the police out of the ground for having simulated sex.
Oh, no.
Once with a steward and once with an inflatable doll. when Hartlepool are playing Chester away, so they're at Chester, Hangus is asked to perform the halftime lottery draw. And he gets so into his role that he pulls all the tickets out of the tombola, throws them up the air and walks away without picking a winner. So authentic.
Yeah.
Very authentic monkey behavior.
Yeah, I mean, he's really in character. It's method, Tom.
Yeah. And so he's tremendously popular. He's probably Britain's most popular football mascot and a source of great pride, not just to the fans of Hartlepool United, but the whole city. So when in 2002, this is when the Blair government is very keen on directly elected mayors. And Hartlepool decide that, yeah, we'll go for it. We'll have a directly elected mayor. And so Hangus wants to run for mayor, Hangus, a.k.a. Stuart Drummond. And he's told that he can't enter the mayoral race as Hangus. He has to do it as Stuart Drummond. But he campaigns dressed as the monkey the whole way through.
And he does it as a stunt.
Yeah.
It's a couple of things because it's a stunt for the football club. But also when Tony Blair introduced elected mayors, there was a lot of public antipathy to it, wasn't there? Because a lot of people thought, oh, it's an extra layer of government. We don't need it. It's expensive. And there was a sort of protest against.
Yes. So the whole thing has been pushed by Peter Mandelson, who is Tony Blair's kind of Svengali, Eminence Grease.
Yeah.
And he's the MP for Hartlepool. So he's very much in favour of it. So it's a kind of a Peter Mandelson against local government imbroglio going on.
Yeah.
The chairman of Hartlepool United, you're right. He thinks this is a tremendous stunt. So he puts the money up because you have to pay a deposit if you're running to be an MP. And if you don't get sufficient votes, then you lose it. So he puts the money up for that.
Mm-hmm.
And it is done as a stunt. So the campaign slogan is vote for Hangus. He gives the monkeys.
Right.
And there isn't much of a manifesto, but one of them is that every school child in the town will have a banana.
Yeah.
But there are some kind of serious elements. So they're very keen on promoting sports facilities. So they want to improve sports facilities for people generally in the town. There's a local sports centre that's threatened with closure. And also they want to cut the number of councillors and the local government. So again, that's the kind of idea that it's a kind of anti-government thing, really.
Yes. Yeah.
And amazingly, he beats the Labour candidate by 500 votes. And Mandelson is furious and takes Stuart Drummond to one side, calls him a disgrace, says you've made the whole town a laughing stock. And I think Stuart Drummond somehow reveals that he speaks French and German. And then Peter Mandelson suddenly thinks, oh, actually, this is a guy who will raise our profile on the international stage, and suddenly turns around and says it's tremendous for Hartlepool. And he's tremendous. You know, he's a great success. He makes a great fist of it.
He won three terms.
Yes, he did. He did. And Labour is so cross at always losing that eventually the councillors convene a referendum to abolish the directly elected mayor. So Hangus is the only...
The only mayor of...
Yeah.
Yeah.
The one and only elected mayor.
I'm just looking at the headline in the Northern Echo. Monkey is mayor. The National Post in Canada reports it. Monkey wins mayoralty, regains human form.
But again, it's this theme, isn't it? Of kind of the permeability of humans and apes and monkeys and things.
Well, actually, that's a beautiful link, actually, Tom, into the next little monkey story that I had. Because I think there is a kind of, it's the idea of the slippage, isn't there? Between the categories of monkey and human. So in 1964, an art gallery in Gothenburg exhibited four paintings by the French avant-garde artist Pierre Brasseau. And it was quite well reviewed. So the Gutenberg Posten sent Rolf Anderberg, its top critic, and Anderberg wrote, Brasseau paints with powerful strokes, but also with clear determination. His brushstrokes twist with furious fastidiousness. He's an artist who performs with the delicacy of a ballet dancer. And it was therefore embarrassing for Rolf Anderberg when it turned out that these paintings had been done by somebody called Peter, who was a four-year-old chimpanzee from Borås Zoo in Sweden. And this was a hoax that had been constructed by a journalist called Dacke Axelsson, who was a journalist at Gothenburg's tabloid newspaper, the Göteborgs Tidningen. So they must have very much enjoyed basically fooling the broadsheet, the posh broadsheet. Apparently what happened was that he'd persuaded the zookeeper to give Peter some paint and a brush. Peter initially ate the paint.
Very surrealist.
But eventually it was persuaded to smear it onto the canvas. Now, apparently... I read at the Museum of Hoaxes website, Tom, top quality research, that Peter had a load of bananas with him. And the more bananas he ate, the more creative and the more progressive his artistic vision became. A Swedish art investor actually bought one of these pictures for the equivalent of about £500.
I mean, were they good?
No, they're terrible. But actually, do you know what? It's the 1960s. So, you know, who can tell? The critic... To be fair, Rolf Anderberg, who had praised them, said, when it was revealed, he said, they're still the best pictures in the exhibition.
Yeah, that's funny.
And it made me think about, so the most famous artistic monkey these days is a painting rather than an artist. Do you remember the story of the Ecce Homo
in
Borja, Spain?
Yes, the thing of Jesus.
Which was restored by an elderly lady, a 1930s fresco, and she basically turned him into a monkey. So that's probably the most famous artistic monkey.
There was another... chimpanzee that actually impressed Picasso. And this, I think, was sponsored by Desmond Morris.
Oh, very good.
Who wrote The Naked Ape.
Yes.
So Desmond Morris was an amazing guy. He was a surrealist painter. I mean, he was a friend, I think, with Picasso. But he was also, I think he was the keeper of the mammals at London Zoo and a primatologist.
I mean, his book, The Naked Ape, which I think was published in 1967, a very 60s book.
It's very groovy, isn't it?
It is.
It's all about how earlobes are erogenous and...
It is, but it's very... People diss it now, but the introduction, there are 193 living species of monkeys and apes. 192 of them are covered with hair. The exception is a naked ape self-named Homo sapiens. This unusual and highly successful species spends a great deal of time examining his higher motives and an equal amount of time studiously ignoring his fundamental ones. He's proud that he has the biggest brain of all the primates, but attempts to conceal the fact that he also has the biggest penis.
Yes. So the highest ratio of penis size to body mass of any primate, yeah. Apparently.
Yes.
Very exciting.
So Desmond Morris, I mean, like lots of 60s stuff, it's kind of sex obsessed, isn't it?
Yeah. Well, he says that humans are naked because it enhances tactile pleasure.
Is that his claim?
Yeah. And he says that the human breast is rounded because it enhances sexual pleasure or something. I mean, it's so 60s because it comes out in 1967, I think, doesn't it?
I think it's fair to say that feminist critics have a strong dislike for the naked ape.
Yeah.
Not unreasonably, but I think it was an interesting book and it's very much of its time because thinking of human beings as essentially animals is no better than any other animal. And the, as it were, the bestial impulses in the human soul, that's a very 1960s, post-Second World War kind of fascination.
And he, Desmond Morris, like Bubbles, is still alive.
Is he?
Yeah, he lives in Ireland.
So two characters from this podcast are still with us.
Yeah.
And may well both be listening to The Rest is History right now.
It'd be nice to think, wouldn't it?
Yeah. So actually, mention of Desmond Morris brings us to our final ape. And the most important, and actually not an ape, it's a monkey.
It's orangutan, isn't it?
Orangutan.
So that's an ape.
Okay, I'm not. I'm a primatologist, Thomas. I think everyone can tell by now. So Jenny was an orangutan in London Zoo in the late 1830s. The London Zoo was the world's oldest scientific zoo, founded famously by Sir Stamford Raffles, Tom, the founder of Singapore. Mm. And Jenny had arrived from Borneo at the end of 1837. A sailor called Mr. Moss sold her for £150. She was probably 3 years old and she was put in a... All the animals in those days were kept indoors. So she was kept in a heated giraffe's house. She wore human clothing and she drank tea. So very Corporal Jackie behavior. Mm-hmm. And in March 1838, the 28th of March, she has a very well-known visitor. And it's the same person that you began this podcast with, Tom.
So we're bookending it.
Beautifully constructed episode. It is Charles Darwin. So Charles Darwin, he's come back from the Beagle expedition 2 years earlier, and he's been writing in his notebooks thoughts about evolution, about the possible links between humanity and other primates for about 12 months or so. And he writes to his sister about this first encounter with Jenny. And he describes her in human terms. So the keeper offers her an apple. She threw herself on her back, kicked and cried like a naughty child. She looked very sulky. The keeper says, Jenny, if you stop bawling and being a good girl, I'll give you the apple. Darwin says, she certainly understood every word of this. And like a child, she had great work to stop whining. She at last succeeded and then got the apple. Now, orangutans at that point are pretty unknown to Europeans. They have been a mystery about the 1600s. It was a Dutch doctor called Jacobus Bontius who went to Java and wrote about orangutans, the wild man of the woods, you know, that kind of stuff. Mm. And naturalists had often said, gosh, they are very similar to humans. You know, been really been unsettled by them, actually. So Linnaeus, when he did his classification, he had put orangutans and other apes
in the 18th century, yeah,
in the same genus as humans. Rousseau, not a friend of The Rest is History, I would say, Rousseau.
No.
He said, could they be a race of genuinely wild men? In other words, are they basically human? Jean-Baptiste Lamarck, kind of pioneer of evolutionary thinking in some ways, he said, could they be the ancestors of humans? Are these our ancestors who have somehow been preserved? And all of these ideas are clearly knocking around Darwin's brain, and he comes back. He keeps coming back. That's the fascinating thing, to the zoo, to look at Jenny. We know from his notebooks, he says, he describes her always as a child, and he says she can do things like groom herself. She can use tools. He's really struck by her emotions, so he's convinced that she's jealous. He says she will make peevish noises. If she sees other people getting attention, she shook the cage and knocked her head against the door because she could not get out, jealous of attention to other. And then the thing that he's most struck by, they give her a mirror, or he gives her a mirror, and he says, she was astonished beyond measure looking in this mirror, and Darwin was convinced that she recognized herself. She stuck out her lips like kissing to the glass. She put a hand over the glass. She rubbed it. She put her body in different kinds of positions, admiring herself in the glass. All of this is massively playing on his mind. He's got multiple notebooks, and this is one called Notebook C, and he writes in this after visiting Jenny. Let man visit orangutan in domestication, hear expressive whine, see its intelligence when spoken to, as if it understands every word said, see its affection, see its passion and rage, sulkiness and variations of despair, and then let man boast of his proud preeminence. Man in his arrogance thinks himself a great work, worthy of the interposition of a deity, more humble, and I believe true, to consider him created from animals.
There you go.
And there you have it.
Yeah.
So Jenny died from an illness a year later, 1839, and was replaced, the cynicism of Zoo's Tom was replaced by another orangutan called Jenny, who wasn't visited by Darwin, but was visited by Queen Victoria. But that last point that Darwin makes, that's obviously the real fascination, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we see ourselves looking back at us.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant way of contextualizing our own kind of boastful narcissism. If you've ever been to a zoo, I actually am transfixed by watching gorillas and chimps and all that kind of thing, because precisely for that reason, because they are so human, or rather we are so
ape-like. Well, we are apes. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly.
Well, brilliant, Dominic. Thanks very much. So those are history's top monkeys,
yeah,
and apes.
Of that, there can be no doubt, Tom.
We hope you've enjoyed it. And we'll be back next week to look at more history of apes.
More apes.
But specifically, Homo sapiens.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.